Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Rhodes, coming to you from Fort Worth in Texas. And today I welcome the co-author of an absolutely fascinating new book entitled The Nepalese Shamanic Path, Practices for Negotiating the Spirit World. Evelyn C. Rice-Dyke is an internationally recognized shamanic healer, teacher, speaker, and author. And she's written several books, including one about Norse shamanism and another about spirit walking, a course in shamanic power. She shares her skills through her organization, Spirit Passages, and is a featured presenter on the Shift Network, Sounds True, and other outlets. The book's also co-written by Bola N. Bastola, 27th generation shaman from Nepal, and he conveys his deep insights in the book too. So that's fascinating as well. So it's a joy, though, to welcome Evelyn to today's show. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. This will be fun.
You know, I love the book because it leads us. You know, I've read and had a lot of shamans on my show, and you know, a lot of it is kind of esoteric, and they keep it so in a certain degree. But what I love about this book is you lay it out very clearly, you know. And if you wanted to follow some of these journeys and rituals and practices that are involved in connecting to the various entities, deities, whatnot, you know, it's laid out there step by step. I've never seen that before in a book like this, And that to me is fascinating because I did one or two myself in preparation for the show. Certainly not in the depth perhaps that it would require if I did the whole preparation, but just to get a feel for it. And powerful stuff, isn't it? You really are very open about sharing the each detail of the way the path unfolds in this regard.
Well, I think that's important. You know, we don't live in a shamanic culture, and we need to have a bridge built between our Western ways of being and the ways of our ancestors, our deep ancestors. And I think the step-by-step approach is really one of the best ways to feel as though you're not getting into too deep a water before you start, you know, and you can just follow your steps, know where you're going to a degree, and then more easily surrender to your experience. If you know,
yes.
You know, it's like knowing you have your training wheels on, and then you can really go for it.
Well, I think many people, when they think shamans, you know, they think, you know, very atavistic, very ancient, pre-religious, you know, paganism, whatever, and not very sophisticated sometimes, you know. But the truth is, it's highly sophisticated, isn't it? And what I love about the shamanic tradition in Nepal is that it, you know, invokes much of Hinduism and certainly some parts of Buddhism as well. So, you know, it takes on the subtleties of those traditions, you know, at the same time. You know, I spent a while in Nepal back in the 70s, and I went back in 2000. And part of what I loved about the place was what you described, you know, the sheer amount and variety of practices. Well, the variety of ethnic types, number one, and each has a different flavor and inflection, right? And each of them has, you know, a different approach to shamanism. So very rich landscape, both spiritual, cultural, as well as physical, right? So you can feel, it's palpable there. You can feel the presence of energies very clearly. You know, in some places it's more hidden, but there's places where the veil is thinner, and that seems to be, especially the Kathmandu Valley seems to be one of the places where the veil is very thin.
I also think their priorities are very different. You know, in Western tradition, our spiritual practices don't tend to be the forefront of how we view the world. And in Nepal, my experience was being touched by the fact that people's spirituality was the way they set the tone for the day, how they carried on their day. They had, even small shopkeepers would have a small altar space where they made offerings to the deities that they honored, the spirits of nature as well. And that sense of having a spirituality so well integrated into ordinary reality is much more like the way our deep ancestors worked. You know, shamanism comes out of survival, needing to have some tool to give you answers to questions that we couldn't answer using our ordinary senses. We needed to expand beyond them. And there's a wonderful, I'm listening to your British accent, and there is a PhD in named Mike Williams in the UK that believes all of our ancestors were expanding consciousness all the time, every night, because fire flickers at the same brainwave state that is our visionary brainwave state. You know, it's high alpha, theta, and it also includes beta and delta waves. But that particular rhythm that you see replicated or hear replicated in journey drumming, the trance dances, repetitive rattling, happens with flickering fire. And if you've ever been in a place where you have a bonfire outside and in a very dark place, everything is strobing to that rhythm. The light is flickering on everything around that is illuminated by the fire. And so people were expanding consciousness every evening. And those that got really good at being able to use that state and remember and interact with the beings that they met while they were in that state became the shamans, just in the same way that somebody in the group that was really good at mapping flint would be in charge of making those arrowheads or knives, or somebody who is especially good and quick at making cordage would be in charge of making nets and snares. So it really comes out of a survival tradition. It was part of ordinary reality, even though it is an extraordinary or expanded reality of working. It really comes from a place of being integrated into everyday life. And when you go to a place like Kathmandu and you see people, no matter what their traditions are, integrate so seamlessly their spirituality, it's startling, stunning, and also incredibly heart-touching, because there's something so authentic and deep that gets stirred, at least in myself, when I see people having no gap between their ordinary lives and their spirit lives.
And we yearn for this, I think, in the West. You know, that's why shamanism has become, you know, more and more popular recently. And people go to South America, you know, and do ayahuasca ceremonies, whatnot. Or they go to, you know, Native American traditions and seek out that way of a path. You know, so I think we in our modern world, we're so disconnected in some ways, right? It's the world of the screen kind of thing, that we want to get back to something visceral, something earthy again, and real, authentic. You know, back in the day, of course, you know, you mentioned Britain. You know, the same thing was happening there. We had all these deities and entities throughout the landscape, you know, of the holy well and the mountains, and today we sort of think of it as a sort of a childish thing, you know, elves and fairies and all these things, but really these are, you know, metaphysical or symbolic representations, aren't they, of the energies and forces that are all around us, and the shaman understands that, you know, these are not little children's games, they're actually ways of explaining the amazing subtlety of the created order, if you like, which is constantly flowing and changing. And I think that's what the thing I brought, got me from the book too, is the you know, the shaman is in touch with the flow, with the fact that things never stay the same, and that's the power of the shaman, because it can harness that, those energies. They're not static, you know, they're in constant flux.
Yeah, I agree, and I think we relate more easily to beings with faces. So the spirits of nature, if you think about the vitality of the woods, for instance, we can relate to animals because they have bilateral symmetry and they have eyes and ears and things, and we can relate to that kind of being. And so we tend to, across the board in shamanic traditions and early pagan traditions, to personify in some way those energies, so we have a bridge built between us, so we have a way to interact with them, mm-hmm. to honor them with gratitude, to speak with them when we are feeling lost or disconnected. That need to be able to communicate is so profound in us as human beings that we often, build that kind of bridge of, I see that spirit as someone I can speak to. And I find that to be quite beautiful, and I also know that spirits are willing to take a form so that they can communicate. You know, the rest of the natural world does not understand itself as separate in any way. It's only human beings that can have the perception of separateness, because we really aren't separate, as the Earth is really good about reminding us about. We are not separate, and yet our minds tell us that we are, and our senses continue to show us that, there's distance between you and I, and in this case, several states away. We are separate from the forest when we're inside, so that our own senses tend to spin that web of separateness as well. And without it, excuse me, put my mute on for a second here. Without that way to communicate, to in some ways antidote the limited information we get from our senses, we can fall into that trap of feeling disconnected, and from that place of disconnection really wreak havoc.
Well, yeah, and we see it all around our world right now. You know, this idea that the Earth is a commodity, right, rather a resource to be mined and destroyed, you know, and developed, as they say. You know, and lost touch with the sacredness of it.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. We also treat our own species that way, that people are only valuable if they provide a service, if they are able to work, if they provide revenue for the corporation. So, you know, it really does go across the board. I apologize again for interrupting.
No, that's fine, no problem. And I was going to say, it even happens in Nepal, you know, because when I went back there in 2000, having been there for several months in the 70s, I was still charmed by it, but I was appalled by what had happened to the city. You know, the Chinese had built a ring road back in the late 60s, early 70s, I think, and the ring road was basically outside the city. But when I went back, the ring road was pretty much in the middle of the city. It's like they had grown that much. And, yep. You know, the sprawl happens and, you know, deforestation is a problem. So, you know, there's always that push and pull between the traditional shamanic sensibilities and modern development, right? Which unfortunately, you know, it's there to supposedly improve things, but often it can damage more than it improves, and so there's got to be a balance there, and you know, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? That I think if there's an essence to the shamanistic way, it's the balance between the two worlds, the maintaining that order that comes from, you know, being on the threshold, right, between the unseen and the seen world, between the spirit and matter, if you like.
Yes, I agree. And you're right. And that's really happening everywhere from that point of view of, and I think, unfortunately, the misrepresentation of the teachings of Jesus, we'll just say it that way, of somehow thinking that we have dominion over nature, This is probably the biggest flaw or biggest mistake we have made, because we can't have dominion over something that we are a part of. That is saying that what we think is wiser than what nature has been doing for, you know, hundreds of millennia. And that is incredibly narcissistic and unfortunately really limiting, because we have interrupted something that is perfection in a way. Nature is really brilliant at creating balance. It's brilliant at figuring out how to deal with weather shifts and with a wildfire and with a flood. It's brilliant at that. We are not so smart, even though we love to call ourselves the wise men, you know, Homo sapiens sapien. We are not so wise. We are never as wise as nature, even though our ego tells us we are.
Right, exactly. Yep. And, you know, contributing to or surrendering, letting go into that divine order of the universe, you know, is what we call enlightenment, right? It's letting go of thinking we know it all and trusting that there is this intelligence that's throughout everything. And it's obviously there, because, you know, just looking out in my garden, I see the most amazing things. I see insects that I could never have created in a million years, you know, with a variety of coloration, whatever. And, you know, it's just testimony to me of the vibrant creativity of this universe. And to despoil that is kind of a form of insanity. So that's another aspect of shamanism, isn't it? To restore sanity, you know, which is part of order to the planet. The book starts off by talking about how you can become a shaman. I thought that was quite interesting. There are different ways, right? It could be lineage from family, or it could be from an illness or an experience that you've had when you were young. And I know a lot of spiritual people, both enlightened gurus and those of us who are, you know, open to this, experienced something in childhood or adolescence where, you know, we either had an illness or a shock or a trauma that broke us open somehow, right, to this world. And once we've had the glimpse, you know, you can never really go back again. That seems to be a common thread, doesn't it, in terms of opening to this perspective?
It absolutely. And, you know, there are two kinds of general ways that we approach shock and trauma, whether it be an illness or a disruption of some kind. One is to crawl into the smallest hole you possibly can, which is sort of the fundamentalist path, whatever particular tradition you practice, that fundamentalist kind of, just tell me exactly what I need to do to keep me safe.
Yeah.
Or that expansive view where whatever it is that has happened to you is now like the stone in the pool, created these enormous ripples that expand you into this state where whatever it is that happened to you has these ramifications that open you up. And I both of those paths, I think, are so separate. You know, one is based on this surrender where you go, okay, I don't know where this is taking me, but there's some piece of trust inside of me to simply stay with whatever the process is. And the other reaction, the closed-down reaction, is fear. And we know when people are afraid, they are not functioning with the full capacity of their brain. They're in that fight, flight, or freeze, and they are biochemically denied access to their upper brain. So those two methods are antithetical to one another, and most shamanic practitioners that have had that kind of deep experience have somehow chosen from that place sometimes of there is nothing left that makes sense. So you simply stay with the process, and through that staying with the process, you receive what it is you need to carry on and take the next steps. There's something very profound about surrender, not surrender to another entity, but surrendering to your own soul. And that place where the ego and where that all the preconceived notions no longer work. You know, it's like the slate has been wiped clean, and you have to be in the moment, surrender to know that there's some part of you that is far more intelligent, as it is part of nature, far more intelligent than no matter how intelligent your brain seems to be, because your brain has run out of options, you know, so there must be something else. And you let yourself go into whatever that experience is. And in doing that, you discover resources that you didn't know were possible, because your ego, which, you know, we need some degree of ego as a operating system to deal with the world, but when it starts to drive the ship, we get in trouble. And when that is sort of wiped away temporarily, you have to let this other wisdom burble up, the part of us that knows, you know, we are animals that are part of nature, that nature is there for us, holding us, feeding us, allowing us to breathe, allowing us to, you know, be nurtured. And now take that in as the next step. And then perhaps you will start to get visions, knowings, dreams that can support you to take whatever your next step is. You know, it's sometimes harrowing, for sure. But that piece of allowing, you know, we're so ready to interrupt a process to get to the end quickly because we're uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so
we want easy answers. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we want to skip to the back of the book, right?
Right.
So if we
interesting. You should bring this up, because we were discussing on a previous show, you know, the difference between a long path and the short path. The short path is that immediate enlightenment kind of thing, and then the long path is the path of discipline. They're not mutually exclusive, though. You know, you need both. Once you've had the glimpse, then you have to go back into the world and make sense of it, and that takes some discipline. But that doesn't mean you can't have the immediate awakening either, because that's the joy, you know, when you have the breakthrough and you surrender to all that is, as you put it in your book, you know, that's very valid too. And so the two are kind of married together. And I think it's the same with shamanism, isn't it? You know, there's these intense moments of unitive awareness. But there's a lot of preparation and sweat that goes in, you know, as well in the ceremonies to make sure that can be possible. And it's not always possible. You don't always get those breakthrough moments, but some work is being done always. So, you know, it's a both and world, as we like to say on this show. It's not an either or, it's a both and.
Yeah, after the nirvana experience, you still have to do the laundry, you know.
That's after the ecstasy, the laundry. That's right, yeah. Chop wood, carry water, right? Before enlightenment and after enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. Of course, the chopping and the carrying are slightly different, you know, after you've become so-called enlightened, because you're no longer attached to, you know, how you react to these things. You're now free to do them in a more effortless way, and so they become a joy rather than an imposition, right? I think that's the shift, right? Even though they may seem hard, they're not really hard, because our response to them has changed. It's fascinating stuff, isn't it? It's all a conundrum or a paradox, the spiritual life, or this human life.
Right. Even us talking about it, you know, we're talking about it in some ways in the abstract, when it really is an experiential thing. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, to guide people with a sense of you can do this, you've been wired for it, and do it with a light touch. Do it with a touch that's loving, and that you're unafraid to make mistakes, that you're unafraid to feel like a fool, because that's part of the journey. You know, we're not always going to know what the next step is. All we can know is where we are now, and then know that something will open up, and we have to be able to be patient and trusting that some little doorway will open, and then it's up to us to step through that doorway and take a next step. So it's this beautiful dance between what's happening around us in terms of support, in terms of opportunity, and our willingness to be still when there is no opening, and then when something opens, to take action.
Right.
That dance is so important.
And, you know, what's crucial in that, and you're absolutely right, is that there's no judgment here, right? It's not a, you make a mistake in the old way of thinking, then you judge yourself, you know, oh dear, I'm bad, I'm a bad person. But in the more enlightened path, you make a mistake and you the witness notices, oh yeah, well, that wasn't very skillful. Let's redirect, let's correct that. Rather than judging it and saying I'm a bad person, you say, oh, this is interesting, you know, my humanness went down that path today. And it's so enhancing of ourselves rather than beating up on ourselves. So I love that approach, you know, because it's more sane, it's more healthy minded, you know, as William James might put it, you know, it's a healthy aspect of the soul rather than an aspect of a sick soul. And again, shamanism is all about that, isn't it? Moving beyond the sick soul to the healthy soul, you know, healing some of our dark places. Folks, when we come back after the break, I want to talk in more detail about some of the deities, ritual objects, and other aspects of the shaman experience in Nepal, because it's very rich in that regard, and delve into some of those things. But right now, I want to thank Evelyn C. Rice-Dyke for being with me. And once again, she's the author of The Nepalese Shamanic Path, Practices for Negotiating the Spirit World. Another plus in this book is the amazing photography, because she's photographed a lot of places and entities in Nepal. But also, she's an artist in her own right and has done some beautiful drawings of various aspects of the shamanic path in the book. So that's another bonus. And just in case people want to find out more about you, Evelyn, what have you got a website?
I sure do. The easiest way.
I thought you might.
Yeah. The easiest way to contact me is through spiritpassages.com.
Spiritpassages.com. Right.
Spiritpassages.com. Yes.
And this book, of course, folks, is in all the usual outlets, so you can get it easily. Co-authored by Evelyn C. Rice-Dyke and Bola Nath Banstola. Join us after these messages from Unity.
Discover the power within. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
When listeners like you contribute to Unity Online Radio, you're making a positive difference in your life and the lives of other spiritual seekers. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate to make a one-time donation. Or sign up for monthly contributions. Thank you for your support.
Here's a Unity Mindful Moment by Ed McShane, a coach for your heart.
I used to belong to the if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands club. These days, given the person I live with, it's a little closer to if you're happy and you know it, just be okay with that. My actions of unbridled excitement and happiness need not necessarily be seen. I can express my joy with the bathroom door closed and the shower running. I don't need another person to experience my demonstration of joy for my feelings to have meaning to me. This doesn't mean that you should suppress your expression of joy, not in the least. Others can just see and feel your joy through your energy. Joy can be peaceful, active, loud, expressive, warm, and silent. There can be great peace in joy. Sometimes, decide to embrace it with genuine confidence within the serenity joy can bring.
To find out more about A Coach for Your Heart, visit acoachforyourheart.com.
Experts say picking up a pen and paper and writing things down can have some amazing benefits. Spark some creativity by sketching, doodling, and writing down what you want in life with a set of Unity Inspiration Notepads. They come in three inspirational designs with themes of gratitude, intention setting, and visualization. These are great tools to keep on your desk and use every day. Just $12.99 for a set of three. Pick up yours today at unityonline.org/shop. Sometimes you might feel so alone with your problems, you don't know where to turn. We invite you to call Silent Unity, the 24/7 prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you every day at any hour. Listen and relax as you hear their beautiful words affirm the highest and best outcome for you and those you love. No matter what's going on in your life, Silent Unity is always standing by. Call today, 816-969-2000.
Recovery from addiction can be a lonely experience. Get help and support with Reverend Lonnie Vanderslice, Reverend Dan Beckett, and Spirit of Recovery every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Central. Welcome to a place where spirituality and recovery meet. Each week, you'll hear stories and topics that are important to the recovery community. Tune in for some lively conversation and join in with your questions and comments. Nearly 21 million people struggle with addiction in America. Reach out and join us here on unityonlineradio.org.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Evelyn C. Reisdyke, and we're talking about her book, The Nepalese Shamanic Path, Practices for Negotiating the Spirit World. And a lot of the book talks about the various aspects of the various objects, I should say, and tools used in ritual practice, and then the cosmology and the deities. And Nepal is very rich in that regard. So let's talk about some of those, because each object has a symbolic purpose, right? We don't just have things because they're fun to have. There's important symbolism involved and help us create and that's the first thing. We have to create some kind of mandala or altar, right, that contains or represents the cosmos, so we can do our work within that space, a bit like in Wicca, where you create a circle for your coven or whatever. It's a similar tradition, I guess.
Well, it's kind of like a control panel in a way, you know. Since the cosmos has no single center, wherever it is that we declare our intent to work with the spirits in whatever form we have, we are basically standing in the center of the world, since the center of all worlds, because it can be anywhere and everywhere. So there's usually some kind of vertical representation of what would be the world pillar or the world tree, and then around that are objects that represent the elements, represent the deities, whatever spirits that you happen to work with in a shamanic practice. And you have then this concrete representation of what would typically be an invisible map. You now have a tangible map when you set up your altar. And from that, you recognize whatever it is that you do is affecting all the worlds, and it sort of puts you on, brings your full attention to the process. Let's put it that way, that
right.
You are affecting the cosmos when you are at the altar. But by the same token, that practice of doing your work with these representations reminds you that even when you're not at the altar, you're affecting the cosmos.
Yeah, through everything that you think, say, and do, right? It's all part of
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
So to do it intentionally, can be very powerful. As long as we understand, what this purpose of these symbols are, because some people will look, and you mentioned earlier about we like, the human form anthropomorphize these elements, and that's very true. But then along comes the iconoclast and says, this is silly. The God doesn't look like Lakshmi or whatever. So we have to break down the imagery, and we can't see it as a portal. It just becomes a barrier. So that's part of the humanness of us, I guess, that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So it only works if you have a willingness to participate in it, right? If you see it as a silly bunch of nonsense, then that's what it becomes for you, right? Even though it may be quite profound, you just can't penetrate into it.
Right, and recognizing that you have co-participated in making this non-physical being physical in some way, so that you have an opportunity to interact with it. So, yes, the deities are these spacious, numinous beings that are everywhere all at once, right? But we need to have some kind of contact point in order to do our gratitude rituals, for instance, because being in gratitude is so much a part of being a shamanic practitioner, saying thank you all the time because we're being taken care of all the time by the elements, by nature. And so there's this practice of doing offering ceremonies because it puts, first of all, puts the reminder in us that we are always having to balance those books. It's part about keeping balance and harmony. We can't only make withdrawals from the bank. We have to also make deposits. And when we do that in our practice and really allow ourselves to feel the gratitude, we become medicine. Because when a person is feeling love or gratitude or appreciation or compassion, and I think some of the easiest ones for us Westerners to deal with is gratitude, because love can be confused with lust and codependence and all kinds of different things, and we're not always clear about what compassion is. Well, is that empathy? Is it sympathy? I don't really know. But everybody can remember something they're grateful for and be able to elicit those feelings in the body. When we elicit those feelings in the body, first of all, our body reharmonizes itself. The hormone bath in our body changes. We have an increase in the hormone of well-being. We have a decrease of cortisol and adrenaline. And in every one of our cells, the DNA actually relaxes into its perfect conformation. And so the DNA in every cell is now more capable of doing its job of cell regulation and repair. The hormone bath puts all of us back online. We can use the upper part of our brain again. And because our feelings are contagious, and shamans may not use that word, but they know it, that when we're in harmony and balance inside, when we're feeling gratitude, we are giving that energy to the world. It simply radiates out from us because we're connected. So that action of taking, making offerings with the feeling of being grateful, you are attending to balance and harmony inside, because that's the sphere of influence that is the greatest, our own being. But we are in turn providing that gift, providing that medicine. We are becoming medicine for all that is. So most shamanic cultures, at least the ones I'm in contact with, spend a great deal of time doing rituals that are gratitude-based. They are making offerings. They're feeding the deities, feeding the land, doing that, support that flow.
I love the word attending, you know, attending to something, paying attention to something, because it's reciprocal. There's a reciprocity involved. You know, there's an old song by Leonard Cohen, So Long, Mary Ann, where it says, "Oh, Mary Ann, you make me forget so much. I forget to pray to the angels, and then the angels forget to pray for us." And I thought, wow, that's a profound line, because it's not that the angels aren't always blessing us, but when we're not aware of it, when we forget to do our part, something breaks down. You know, we need that connection. We need to foster and attend to that connection. It's the same in a relationship. You know, if you're not paying attention to and loving the one you're with and just taking he or she for granted, something is diminished in that relationship. You know, so it has to be honored every day. And I think it's the same in our connection to, as you say, the numinous. You know, that there has to be an awareness that it's available, right? So these tools are ways to do that. You know, whether it's a bell that we ring to wake, it says to wake up the deity, but what it's really doing is waking up our attention to the deity, right?
Exactly.
Or whether it's a sword, you know, a ritual dagger or something which cuts through illusion. You know, it's symbolic of piercing to the heart of something. You know, all these things become empowered when we remember, oh, these are aspects of my, you know, waking up to the wonders that are all around me and giving thanks for those. So yeah, that's beautifully put. You know, there's one image in the book that I just absolutely loved. It's the great cosmic order of things. The story about the Nagas, the snakes in the ocean of the primordial ocean. You know, it's gathering around a conch shell, and then. The turtle comes onto the top of the, you know, snakes, and then these elephants in the eight directions come on top of the turtle, and on top of that comes Mother Earth, and, you know, giving birth to everything. And, you know, whenever there's imbalance, you know, like earthquakes or whatever, it's because we've created that imbalance. We haven't been paying attention to the world order. And I can't help but think, you know, with climate change and the craziness of our weather systems, that, you know, Mother Nature is responding to the lack of balance here that we're exhibiting in our world. And it goes back to those snakes and the elephants are, you know, yearning here for us to return back to some kind of sanity. But that image is tremendously powerful. Obviously, it's not literal. You know, it'd be a fool to take it literally. But the imagery and the symbolism of these power animals, you know, is very, very potent, isn't it?
It is. And what I love about that image is it reminds us how powerful but fragile all that interconnection is.
Yes.
And so, of course, we want to invest in keeping that strong, because how, you know, it's a very ephemeral kind of balance, right? When you have that image of all these things stacked on top of one another, and if anything shifts, the whole thing can come down like a house of cards, right? So with that in mind, you would naturally treat the world of nature and other beings in a very different way, because you know they are part of that house of cards that we have to keep attending to, that we have to care for, not only for our own preservation, but for the preservation of all life. And to have that embedded in you, in that culture, is a powerful, powerful, powerful image. It's a wonderful guide to have in one's life.
And we need all parts too to make that whole work, right? I read an article about Yellowstone National Park and the reintroduction of the wolf has made huge changes. You could say, well, okay, how does it just bringing back an animal make it all those changes? But there's been a cascade as a result, because, you know, the wolf eats some of the elk, which we then can't eat all the plants down in the aspen groves, which allows for more water to flow, which creates more ecosystem for other animals and insects, etc. And so we see this cascading of possibility that didn't exist before, all because you brought back one species, right? And we're understanding now, I think, that, you know, everything is valuable. You can't just extirpate, you know, certain creatures because they're annoying, you know, otherwise you've got a degraded ecosystem and a degraded planet ultimately, right? So everything is here for a purpose. And, you know, I don't like to kill a bug because you know, why would you do that? They belong here somehow. You know, sometimes if they're in my house, I remove them, but I don't just squish them, because I think, you know, that's a precious life here. And you know, everything is valuable, right?
Right. And, you know, we arrogantly as a species, not, you know, present company on both sides accepted here, as a species, we are very arrogant in that we think we know what's important and not important. We have no idea what the keystone species are in most environments. We may have some ideas, but we don't really know. How do we know it isn't that small insect or a particular fish or amphibian that is actually the keystone species or a plant? We have no real idea. And so we've been monkeying with the environment with the idea of we save this species or that species and everything's going to be fine. Such is not the case. We have to preserve intact ecosystems.
Right.
And they rebalance themselves, and in turn, we can learn from that, But we can't impose our idea of what's important and not important over that. It doesn't work.
Yeah, there's another story I read about a ranch in Texas where I live. This man bought this very degraded piece of property and decided to improve it. You know, he started to plant native plants, and especially grass plants. And anyway, he's been doing it for like 20 or 30 years now. And the birds count went from 70 species to 350, something like that. Likewise with all the invertebrates and the insects. And the whole place is cooler than it was. And there were no springs before it all dried up. Now he's got 14 springs running on the same property that was degraded. And all he did was introduce, you know, some healthy practices that, like you said, once you start changing things, then, you know, nature responds to that, I think, you know, if you allow it to happen again. And it's wonderfully inspiring, you know, when we see so much degradation in our world, we have to hold on to those things that, you know, are positive and show that, you know, Mother Nature, given a chance, will rebound.
There's a wonderful he's an older gentleman now. He's I imagine he's in the 80s. He's somebody who is about regenerating forests. His name is Akira Miyawaki, I believe his name is pronounced.
Uh-huh.
Not in front of me, so we'll have to go on my memory. He has figured out how to make even miniature intact forests in the city. So it includes native trees, then the first understory and the lower understory, and actually species that are native to those forests find their way to those little pocket forests. He plants these in really intensively. They've started doing this in India, to reforest India, and it over the course of 3 years, they become self-sufficient. They have to be cared for 3 years, but after 3 years, because the right species are put together, the forest takes care of itself.
Yeah,
so,
that's awesome.
You know, if we just provide just a little help, you know, don't destroy things, and just a little help is all nature needs. You know, and to be in that place of, I love you, Mother. I want to provide what it is you need to nurture your other children. You know, that's such a simple thing. And, you know, we don't even care for our human elders very well. You know, we have this idea of what's valuable and not valuable that is very cockeyed in Western culture. And I think the earth is trying to teach us, and apparently we're quite hard-headed because the lessons are getting harder and harder, to recognize, wait a minute, stop. Let's reprioritize what is important. What is important? We need to be in relationship with one another, with the other species, with the forces of nature. And that is what shamanism teaches, and it's certainly what Bola teaches in his work.
Right. Yeah, let's talk about Bola, because he sounds like a very fascinating man. And he's written parts of the book, especially when he talks about his enlightenment experience when he was at 9, I think, and he had a journey to the shamanic entities, right, to the presiding deities. That was fascinating. And then he also talks about the rituals and the various myths and legends associated with some of the parts. So there's rich cosmology in the book that he shares. And I'm sure he shared a lot of all the practices as well with you, and you've transcribed them in that way. So tell us more about him.
Well, I want to say this book is such a tiny slice of what is a remarkably rich tradition.
Right.
I basically was telling him for a few years, you need to have a book. And he's such a busy man. He says, I'm not going to be able to write a book. I said, listen, I will write the book, and I will ask you for what I need to make a good book. And I wanted to do that for two reasons. One is, he is an extraordinary teacher and needs to be exposed to a wider group of people around the world, because he's really practicing this ancient tradition in a way that's really accessible. His English is very good, and so he also speaks Italian, Hindi, at least two Nepalese languages. He's very fluent in being able to speak and translate his culture into language that people understand. That being said, I also saw when he taught Westerners that there would be a level at which people could not penetrate the information because they had been programmed by their culture in a very, very different way, and that they needed more bridges to be able to receive the information on a deeper level, because it's easy to kind of replicate a ritual that you're participating in with a group. But unless you have the layered meaning internalized in your body, you really aren't getting the full benefit of the experience. And what I found was people's, you know, Westerners by and large are products of the religions of the Levant. And that's Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And those traditions have the divine being separate from human beings. We've been cut off in some way, and we have to strive to get closer and closer to the divine. Eastern traditions have the idea that everyone and everything is part of the divine, and your journey is of greater and greater awareness of that truth. So those two things don't necessarily fit together. So when Westerners are presented with the idea of these deities, it kind of is jangling in some ways, because does that mean I have to believe in them? And and it's like, no, this is a tool by which you can get closer to your own experience of the divine and that broader sense of the divine that includes all beings. And so to help people build that bridge and then to take the ritual step by step so that they can really internalize what that ritual, what that ceremony means for them is, I think, critical in practicing shamanic work of any kind. You know, it's a first-person direct divinatory practice. That's the idea of shamanism. You go directly to the spirits. You don't require a priest or an intermediary. And to prepare somebody well enough so that they can do that. They're not stumbling over the steps. They're not feeling uncomfortable with the imagery or the particular spirit, the form the spirits take. They have some kind of a container that they can then dive into that and see, does this fit me? Do I feel at home performing my gratitude in this particular form? Do these tools call me to help me with my own shifts and transitions in my life? Like you say, I think of the purba or the kirpa that they call it in Nepal, that dagger that represents the realms of the upper worlds, middle world, and lower worlds. It represents that axis mundi. It also can be used to both bless and release toxins or entities that are unbeneficial. That, in some ways, is both the map of the cosmos and the role of the shaman in a tool. So the more that you learn to work with that tool, you are expressing a deeper and deeper sense of connection. And you have to have that kind of container, I think, to be able to step deeply into a practice and feel it and breathe it and experience it, to be able to have any sense of being able to take it in and have it be a part of your life.
Right.
And I think his work really deserves that.
And I think, you know, for our listeners, it's important that we use our own intuition here with that, because otherwise we're sort of playing games, you know, we're doing it as we're following the process, but we're not really owning it. And sometimes it's better to, you know, intuitively understand what some implement or some entity or deity means for you, you know, to trust that, because, you know, that's more important perhaps. You know, it's like the old story of the monk, the people on an island who couldn't remember how to chant correctly. So the cardinal came and spent 3 months teaching them, and he was leaving by ship, and they'd already forgotten how to chant correctly. So they started rushing out across the water walking across the water to say, "Hey, we've forgotten." And he looked back at seeing them walking on the water. He said, "Hey, if you're praying it, saying it wrongly, it doesn't matter. You're obviously doing something right because you're walking on water here." trust your own intuition, right, rather than going through all the outer observance. However, having said that, you know, these outer observances are there for a purpose. They've been crafted over millennia, and so if you really take them to heart, they're going to help you get into the one thing I want to say before we finish, because I loved, if you want to find out more about some of the subtleties of the various deities, this book is for you folks, because I'm very attracted to Durga, the female, the divine feminine in its invincible, strong form. But through the 9 days of Navaratri, there's various aspects of Durga, and it's laid out in the book. It was very fascinating to me to see all the various aspects of Divine Mother, you know, as she shows up, and I can resonate with each one. So you initially you'd say, "Well, that's kind of complicated," but then no, we are complicated beings. We have a lot of subtle ways of looking and seeing things, and they explicated it well. We haven't got time to go into it, but I thought it was a very fascinating part of the book. We have 1 minute left. Evelyn, what would you like to tell us just in that last minute that might be useful for listeners?
Well, I think you've really kind of hit it on the head about using whatever path opens up to you to make that your tool for uncovering the richness inside. And if it involves something like ceremonies of gratitude, every time you are engaging with the spirit world in a tangible way, you are telegraphing information to your subconscious that this is real. And the more we engage in those ceremonies, making it tangible, the more our subconscious is programmed to know unwaveringly that this numinous world is as tangible as the one we can see with our senses. And
yes,
that tremendous gift.
Beautiful. Let me tell you about next week's program, which is really piggybacking quite well. And then we'll say goodbye to Evelyn. Next week, internationally known percussionist, singer, dancer, and author Alessandra Belloni talks to me. And she's going to talk about her book, Healing Journeys with the Black Madonna, which shares her fascinating pilgrimages and workshops in Italy, and the importance of the divine feminine in today's world. So that's going to be fascinating too. But thanks for joining us. And Evelyn, thank you so much for being with us. What a wonderful book, a wonderful interview. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Me too. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.